Welcome back to The Weekly on WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. I'm Owen Anderson, and with me is Jamie Yu. We are the co-news directors for WOBC this academic year. We hope you all are doing well. For today's show, we have one of the news editors from the Oberlin Review, Ella Moxley. We're looking forward to talking to Ella about her article on COVID-19 vaccinations in the Oberlin City Schools District. Ella, thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi. I'm Ella. I'm a third year studying environmental studies and economics, and my pronouns are she and her.
So to get started, we want to ask you, what drew you to covering the Oberlin City School District for this article?
Well, I think there's two reasons. First is I'm really interested in just like community news because Oberlin doesn't really have like a local newspaper. So I really like for the review not only just to cover like college related things, but also cover things that are going on in the community. And the other reason is that K-12 school reopenings has just been a really controversial subject across the country, and even in Ohio. I think there's a lot of division, even within like the Democratic Party itself, about like, should we reopen schools? Should we close schools? Should students be in the classroom virtually or in person? And a couple weeks ago, the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, came out and basically said that we need to get students back into the classroom by March 1st, which was not too long ago. And so he basically said that he was going to include teachers in one of the early groups of people who are eligible to be vaccinated, that's the 1B group, with the goal of once teachers got vaccinated, allowing students to come back to the classroom. And so I thought it would be a good idea to check in on Oberlin City Schools and see how they were dealing with learning right now and how the vaccination process was going to go for them.
Mm-hmm. That all makes sense. And actually, that was one of our follow-up questions because you cited that DeWine was planning on having students return to school by March 1st. So now that it's March 2nd, as of this recording, have you heard anything from the teachers that you interviewed or, you know, from the school district?
Yeah, so Oberlin Schools, I think, I wouldn't say that Oberlin Schools was unique because I think if you look at Ohio as a whole, a majority of students, like right now in Ohio before the March 1st deadline, were getting like in-person instruction. But I do think that like Oberlin is a little bit special in the fact that students were in the classroom before the March 1st deadline that Mike DeWine like set for the state. So I think for Oberlin, like the like deadline itself was not quite as like, oh, like we need to go and like do a lot of stuff before March 1st because, you know, they already had students in the classroom. I think that getting the teachers vaccinated kind of added to another layer of like security for that process. And Oberlin City Schools itself plan to like kind of expand the amount of students who are getting in-person learning a month from now, so in April, once I think teachers have gone through the entire like vaccination protocol.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, how students have already been returning to in-person schooling, you mentioned in your article that Oberlin City Schools have been successful and that the OCS administration is, quote, only aware of two positive COVID-19 cases since reopening in January. Why do you think OCS has been successful?
Okay, I think there's probably two reasons that, like, you can contribute to this, too. First is that a lot of the data that we're seeing right now about school reopenings just nationally shows that schools aren't necessarily like the hotspot that we once thought they were going to be. So, you know, the CDC came out a couple weeks ago with a big study that said like schools can reopen safely with taking proper precautions and not have like huge COVID outbreaks. And, you know, there's been more and more researchers who've kind of come out strongly saying like, there are signs to show that students can get back in the classroom without causing like COVID outbreaks. I think us at Oberlin like can kind of maybe understand this a little bit. You know, we're in the classroom a couple days a week, and like at least from my experience, it's felt pretty safe. And then the second part of that is I think that the Oberlin City Schools themselves have, like, taken a lot of precautions to keep things safe. So, you know, when I was talking with the schools, they are basically saying that, you know, they're going through all, like, the precautions that you would expect. So students are distancing. They only have classrooms that are, like, one parent told me that, like, normally there's 30 students in the classroom, and right now there's only 6 students in the classroom. They're wearing masks every day. You know, and then there's other things that you might think about, like they got some grants to buy hand sanitizer and other PPE, and they also got a grant that allowed them to, like, change the HVAC system, which, you know, there's some research that shows that, like, good ventilation, like, can help prevent outbreaks of COVID, or, you know, the old fashioned way, like, they told me that they're telling students to bundle up so that they can open up the windows and help with ventilation in the classroom. So all those precautions help, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And I guess going back to, like, the article itself, I remember reading in your bio that you tutor in the district. So do you feel like that gives you a greater connection to the school district and also why you wanted to cover this topic for your article?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so I tutor in the high school, and I haven't been there since, like, the week before Oberlin shut down in March. Which was kind of a scary week, I think, for me and also for the students.
Almost a year ago now.
I know, that's wild. Yeah, it probably was like a year ago. That was the last time I was there. And yeah, I think that, you know, knowing them, like, knowing what they're going through, like, helps. Like, also, like, I'm only a couple years removed from being a K-12 student as well. So, you know, I can only imagine, like, what it must be like to not be able to go to school right now. When I was in high school, my teachers union did, like, a strike, and I was out of school for 2 weeks, and that was a lot. So I couldn't imagine a whole year of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the closest thing I remember to that was I was living in New Jersey during Hurricane Sandy, and my hometown got hit really hard. We had no power for 14 days, and we had no school for 2 weeks. That was probably the strangest 2 weeks I've had in all of middle school. It was just so weird to, like, not have a normal schedule, and, like, nobody really knew what was going on. So I definitely agree. It's just so much, like, displacement and confusion right now, I can imagine.
Yeah, and I think, like, there's also, like, you know, you can imagine that on an emotional level, but I think a lot of, like, experts are saying, like, you know, on a more scientific level, like, that kind of displacement is really bad for students, emotionally, physically, developmentally. And so I think the push to get students back into the classroom is like, really critical right now, because we know that students are really struggling without that kind of face-to-face contact daily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of, like, the school district, I noticed that you interviewed Professor Christopher Trinacti. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah, I just call him Professor T.
Yeah, Professor T, and he mentioned that he has kids in Oberlin City Schools. And even though that's the case, I feel like Oberlin College tends to be in a bit of a bubble, and sometimes it can be easy to forget about the wider community. So why do you think it was important to cover the COVID vaccination developments in Oberlin City Schools for the college newspaper, and not just the college's vaccine plan?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, first of all, like, COVID doesn't discriminate between, like, oh, you're in the Oberlin bubble or you're in the Oberlin community bubble. You know, we all live in this town together, and, you know, it's all connected. So I think it's important that, you know, we're paying attention to what's going on, not just in our college community, but our overall community. And I think that is important beyond just vaccinations or just COVID. You know, we are students who come into this town for 4 to 5 years and then we leave it. And I think that part of that is just learning to be, like, good guests and good citizens. And that means that we should, you know, be aware of what's going on around us. So, yeah.
That's a really good point.
Going off of vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine was recently approved by the FDA. Did you discuss the possible impact of the third vaccine in any of your interviews? Or if not, what impact would you anticipate?
Yeah, so, I mean, not necessarily the impact of this vaccine, but I think for K through 12 schools specifically, the biggest hurdle when it comes to like vaccinations perhaps is the fact that we don't really have any large-scale studies of how like the J&J vaccine or Moderna or Pfizer are going to impact people under like I think the age of 16 is kind of where it's approved for right now. So what that basically means is that the vaccines are not approved for most of the K through 12 population, and I think Dr. Fauci has basically said that he anticipates that there will probably be a study that will allow it to be approved for maybe high school aged kids by the fall, but most likely we probably won't have evidence that allows like the vaccine to be accessed by younger people until well into next school year. So I think what I can imagine the biggest benefit of the J&J vaccine will be is just making sure that the wider community is vaccinated. Because if we can't vaccinate young children soon, it's even more important that we get, you know, community spread under control. And so J&J, I think, will really help with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it really eye-opening when you mentioned that in your article, where you would actually have to consider the safety and viability of young children getting vaccinated. It's something I hadn't really thought about because I don't have any like super young cousins or anything like that. But it's surprising too, because you know when this outbreak first began, a lot of people were saying like, oh, it's a good thing that this virus doesn't affect young children very much, but now we're seeing a lot of variations and that people of all ages can get seriously ill. So yeah, I definitely agree with you in how like vaccination is absolutely necessary to keep community spread under control.
Yeah, especially because I think a lot of the like what experts are saying is like getting younger kids enrolled in these studies is really challenging. You know, I think you can imagine if you're a parent, you're like, oh, like, I don't know if I want to put my small child in this study for this like unknown vaccine, like that can be scary. So, you know, I think we may be waiting a little bit longer for that.
Mm-hmm. And then going back to the people you spoke with, you're wondering, like, were there any parts of the interviews that really stuck out to you that you liked in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that I liked is kind of hearing about what's next for Oberlin City Schools. So basically in April, they're trying to further expand the amount of contact hours that children are getting, like, actually in the classroom. And this is entirely dependent on, like, parent choice. So if a parent doesn't feel comfortable sending their child back to the school, like, they don't have to do it. But so far, from surveys I've done, they've had a lot of interest from parents. I think 70 to 90% range of parents who want their kids back in school. Which kind of basically shows me that, like, you know, parents are ready to, you know, get their child back in school, kind of stop this whole year where things have kind of just grinded a little bit to the halt. And I think teachers are also really excited to, like, you know, be able to, like, work with the students kind of in a more normal way again. But the challenge for Oberlin City Schools, I think, it might just be space. If they have that many students who are interested in coming back to school, what they told me is they want to open the school 4 days a week to in-person instruction. But if there's too many students who want to come back, they might have to sort them into like an A block and a B block, and then students will only get 2 days of school. So, you know, we have tools to deal with COVID, but those tools are kind of restricted by like what resources we actually have available. So.
Mm-hmm. And the hard part is, like, this is all so new. We've never done anything like this before, like, in our lifetimes. So really, like, everything is just brand new and kind of disorienting and confusing.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like, you know, the last year has just been kind of trying to navigate that disorientation. And the next 6 months to a year will probably just be learning to navigate like a new kind of disorientation as we try to like put our lives back to normal. Like, I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges that like teachers might be facing now is really trying to like, you know, keep students not only the students who are going to be coming back to the classroom engaged, but students who can't come back to the classroom engaged, you know, so the students who are still at home learning online, you know, how do you deal with that when your classroom is so divided? So there's definitely going to be new challenges that people are going to have to work for.
And in your interviews, were there any parts of the conversations that you had that didn't make it into the article but still stuck out to you that you'd like to share?
I don't think so. You know, most of it, like, is in the article. I wish that I had been able to look a little bit more into, like, the union side, because that's been controversial with a lot of teachers' unions wanting to keep teachers, you know, at home until we can be sure that this is really safe. But it sounds like OCS and the unions, for the most part, are really keeping, like, an open door policy and really keeping communication lines open. So I think that's really good.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to share more about, like, what you know about this whole union issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think nationally, like, this has been a really big issue. You know, right now, like, I think the Republican Party is really pushing for schools to reopening and saying that, like, Democrats are capitulating to the unions. And Democrats are, I think, trying to be really careful. And I think, you know, teachers are kind of stuck in the middle here with, like, you know, teachers really care a lot about students and they want what to do what's best for students. But also I think it's really difficult to ask teachers to do something that could put them at risk because, you know, traditionally in this country, you know, teachers are a really undervalued profession. And I think historically we really have not invested in teachers in the way we should. So I can really understand, like, being hesitant to kind of go back into the classroom under this kind of scenario. But I do think things are definitely changing. We're learning more about the virus each day. And so, you know, we're learning ways to, like, get back and do it safely. So it's really good that Oberlin is, like, working with teachers' unions rather than kind of having the kind of combative relationship that I think a lot of school districts and unions are having right now. Like, if you look at, like, something like Chicago, I think is a good example of that.
Mm-hmm. And I have seen a lot of posts recently where, you know, COVID and the U.S. response has really exposed a lot of holes in our systems. But I think a big thing is, like, we need to be giving more funding to public education. I feel like all of the challenges faced by school districts, a lot of it can be traced back to funding, I think.
Yeah.
We wanted to pivot a bit and ask you more about, like, your time at the Review. So is it that you started out as a writer before you became the news editor?
Yeah, so I started writing my freshman year, and yeah, I've grown a lot since then. I don't have any kind of, like, background in journalism, so I wasn't, like, on, like, my school paper when I was in high school. I don't even know if my school had a school paper, actually. When I got to Oberlin, I was really looking for, you know, something to do, something to get involved in. I loved the Oberlin Review. I loved reading it. So I was like, well, maybe I'll try writing for it. And yeah, then I became a staff writer my sophomore year. And then this summer I started as news editor.
Mm-hmm.
And what drew you to the news section?
I just love news. Like, I did debate in high school. So I basically, all I did in high school was, like, read the news. And so I was just really interested in it. And then also, I just love that, like, news, you get a really interesting cross-section of, like, the politics of, like, higher education, the politics of, like, living in a small town in Northeast Ohio. And also you just, like, really get to know, like, the town and the place that you're in, which is important to me because I grew up in a college town. I've always lived in different college towns because my parents work for universities. And so I know what it's like to kind of be a resident in a college town and just be so frustrated by college students who kind of come and go as they please and, like, make traffic in your town and, you know, take your parking spots. And so I thought it was really important that, you know, if I'm going to live in Oberlin for 4 years, that, you know, I know Oberlin, and being the news editor and writing for news has really helped me do that.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I never really considered that perspective before. So you became the news editor this summer. How has that transition been during a pandemic, especially when the review has changed its distribution formatting so much.
Yeah. It's been interesting because, well, I think, Jamie, like, you can kind of appreciate this because you were a production editor and then you were a section editor. And so you, like, I think were in the office probably so much. As a writer, like, I would go to the office maybe, like, once a semester for 5 minutes to, like, ask my editor a question. So coming in during COVID was a little weird because up until the point in which I arrived back on campus this semester, there was a lot of people on the review that I had never really, like, met or had a conversation with. So coming back this semester was a little weird because, you know, I felt like I had worked for the review for so long, but, you know, there's all these people involved in the paper that I, like, didn't really know. So that's been really exciting. Yeah. I think the other big challenge is, like, we're not printing right now, so I don't really, you know, have a lot of, like, familiarity with that process. So it'll be interesting to go back to that.
I'm so glad you get to meet people. And yeah, I imagine the lack of printing really changes the distribution of work, because what it used to be was, like, on Friday mornings, they would be giant printouts of the layout, and you would kind of copy edit, just the production editors would copy edit, like, with pens on the paper and pass around all these giant sheets. So just to thinking about, like, not having that anymore is really jarring for me, because I haven't been in the office since last year. So if I were to return, I imagine it would be quite a shock. How has it been for you, though, like, because you started before the pandemic started? So, you know, how has that difference been, and, like, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's definitely made me more efficient, because I remember, like, my freshman and sophomore year, like, I'd spend, like, all day Wednesday, like, biking around town trying to, like, track down people, like, me biking all the way downtown until I, like, find City Hall, or biking, you know, everywhere and trying to, like, track people down, like, going to people's offices in Rice and they're not there, and so I'll come back an hour later and they're still not there, and, you know, and the pandemic has really made me just realize that I can pick up the phone and call people. That's basically the same thing. So that's, like, kind of nice. I guess there is something lost, though, about, like, you know, like, I spent last semester writing, I wrote, like, every week, and I didn't set a foot in Oberlin. Like, there is something lost, I think, there. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That actually made me think about how, you know, back when I was writing articles, I would always email and say, like, where do you want to meet for an interview? And looking back on it, it's like, why did we schedule that? Like, we could have just had a phone call and I could have recorded it. And there was a professor, like Professor Matt Rary, and I was, like, in a hurry to get quotes from him for an article. And we wound up talking while he was out, like, driving out of state. So that worked out. But then, like, earlier that same year, I had gone all the way to his office that was, like, at a whole nother part of campus that was near the Allen. So I feel like, you know, the nature of, like, remote interviews has kind of exposed, like, why did we go to the trouble of meeting people in person? But at the same time, there is a lot of value to that, to, like, sit across from somebody and have, like, a real face-to-face conversation and, you know, meet someone and shake their hand and be able to, like, gesture and show eye contact and show interest in the conversation. So, you know, even though it was a hassle to, like, track people down, I think it is something I miss a lot, like the in-person interaction.
Yeah, I remember the biggest challenge before was, like, I would always be like, hi, like, can you meet me? Where do you want to meet? And then I would be like, oh, please, please don't say someplace that's really loud where my recording is, like, not going to pick up what you're saying. Please don't shoot a slow train. Please don't. And that, I haven't even thought about that in, like, a year, I guess, which is nice. But I do agree with what you're saying, Jamie. Like, I feel like now my interviews are so, like, hi, like, how are you? Good? Okay, here's my questions. Bye. Whereas they used to be, like, I'd get to know people, I'd hear a lot about their lives, and so that is a little sad, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the same would go for the office space. I mean, the Burton basement, like, you could say, like, oh, it was so cramped and crowded, and it could get really noisy, And why do we need to all be together if we were just copy editing on our computers when we could do that remotely? You still miss it, all that community, the sense of community, and just being able to pop into the next room and ask an editor a question. So there's kind of like upsides and downsides to everything, I suppose.
So before we end, Ella, is there anything else you'd like to add, whether it be related to your article or to your experience at the review or in general?
Yeah, I think one thing I would add is I did talk to one parent who did express some concerns about the way that the hybrid approach to schooling is occurring right now. And this parent basically told me that she doesn't feel comfortable sending her child back to school just because she's worried about COVID. But the challenge has been that when students are in the classroom, those days her child only has asynchronous learning, which is really boring for her kid, doesn't really have a lot of engagement, and is also really frustrating for her because, you know, she used to be able to say, like, okay, go to class, and her child would be interacting with the teacher over Zoom. But now she really has to, like, do a lot of work to keep her child focused and on task rather than having the teacher do it. And so she's been really frustrated by the fact that she kind of feels like her child isn't really getting the kind of attention that, you know, children need to learn right now, but doesn't really feel like she has any choice because she doesn't really want to send her child back to school. So it's just interesting to think about, you know, teachers have been asked to do a lot this last year, and it's, you know, and we're going to have to keep asking them to do a lot in the next couple of months, but really figuring out how to navigate, making sure that, you know, there's equity between students who get to go back to school and students who can't go back to school is going to be the next really important challenge that schools will be facing.
Thank you for sharing. I think that's also a really great insight as well. So thank you, Ella, so much for your time and sharing more about the Oberlin City School District and how vaccinations are going, as well as just like bring more awareness to the surrounding community that I think Oberlin College students could really listen to more of. So it was great to have you on. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Thank you so much for talking with us. You're listening to WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. This has been The Weekly. All previously aired episodes of The Weekly are publicly available online. You can listen to them at anchor.fm/The Weekly.